Welcome back, interweb friends. This is Stop the Movie. I want to get out. I'm going to tweak our tagline. Usually we say Hollywood makes bad movies. We make fun of them. This week it's more like Hollywood makes weird movies. We need to talk about them. I'm Alex Dunbar, joined by Jack Estabrook.
At your service, my liege.
Cody Wolf.
Far out.
And super special guest, Nick Newert.
On my way here, I knocked a guy off a motorcycle. I might be king of the greater Syracuse area now.
You may be.
So, Your Majesty, please, yeah. From here on out.
Our movie this week is 1981's Knight Riders, the George Romero film. And, Nick, every time we bring you in, it reminds me of, for comics fans, it reminds me of, like, classic, like, Silver Age, like, DC stories when, like, the Flash would get into, like, he would, like, struggle with something, and he'd be like, I wonder what Jay Garrick is doing in Earth 2, and he would, like, bring in, like, the Earth 2 Flash to, like, help him solve cases. I feel like that's what we do. Like, we get into we get something we can't handle where we're like, we need extra power.
Bring Nick in.
Yeah.
I've been referred to far worse things than Jay Garrick, so yeah. I'll take that one.
Yeah. If you listened to our mini episode last week, this is one of the flat out weirdest, strangest,
best,
and most endearing movies that we have probably watched on this show. The concept of the movie is from IMDb: Knight Riders, a medieval reenactment troupe, essentially a Renaissance fair, find it increasingly difficult to keep their family-like group together with pressure from local law enforcement, interest from entertainment agents, and a growing sense of delusional something from their leader. It's not grammatically correct, but that does touch on a lot of what's going on. It's essentially a movie about a Renaissance fair where motorcycles are used instead of horses for jousting.
I get the impression if you called it a Renaissance fair in front of Ed Harris's character, he would take a swing at you immediately.
I definitely think that's true. You
owe me $20.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Ed Harris, well, we're getting into Ed Harris's character, who's kind of the king of this Renaissance fair. I think he views this as like,
it's almost like a cult, isn't
this
it?
Is almost like a cult. This is almost like his argument of like a positive cult.
Right.
And this like alternative lifestyle within the U.S.
Yeah.
There are definitely some points where I kind of thought, does he seriously think he's a king?
Oh, there's a couple of points.
Well, there's one point where he did say something like, people think I'm Jim Jones or Charlie Manson. And
yeah.
Like, and kind of,
he said
you're
that
bordering
like,
on that. Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I paused. I'm like, yeah, people like me.
Yeah.
Okay, so to get right into this movie, this is a 2.5 hour long movie, so we're probably going to jump around a little bit in order to not, so that we're not here for 2.5 hours. It starts off as so many movies that we watch do. Ed Harris completely naked, beating himself with a stick in the middle of a river.
A little flatulation in the morning.
Like you do.
Always,
like you do.
How this is, I feel, God, doesn't have,
that's
doesn't
how
Hollywood have
that's
any.
That's how The Happening started, right?
Yeah, that was, we need more original ideas. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
I did notice this because it came out in, what, 81?
Yes.
Like most 80s movies have to. Within that first minute, we get a topless woman.
Yes. Yes.
So I think like the 50-second mark.
Yes.
Yep.
Second person you see on screen is a topless woman.
Yep.
That's right. And Ed Harris is then putting on a knight outfit.
It's like donning armor, and they're playing this like Renaissance-style like flute music, and they're in this beautifully shaded glade, so I get the sense that if you didn't look at the box art, that you'd expect him to hop up on a horse and ride off.
I definitely think they were going for that.
Oh, and absolutely.
Then, yeah, they were going for that. And then the kind of the twist is, nope, he's hopping on a motorcycle, and he and his kind of is the woman who's with him is dressed like a queen, and then they're riding in dressed fully like they're right out of, you know, Knights of Shining Armor days, but on a motorcycle, because they run a Renaissance fair. And we get, and if you don't know what a Renaissance fair is, that's cool because we'll get several montages explaining to you what a Renaissance fair is.
This isn't just any ordinary Renaissance fair.
It is not. It is, although a lot of the montages are very, I'm really not sure why some of the montages are in there with them selling, like, they show them, like, just doing very kind of like boring Renaissance fair things, you know, which is not central to the movie at all.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they just need to kind of establish that world a little bit and to give you, but they do it in like a very newsy kind of way. You almost, as we would say in news, like you're essentially seeing a news VO of a Renaissance fair.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think where I then want to, Well, and this movie's plot is so divergent. I mean, there are so many threads going. We can go in a lot of different directions. I guess we probably should introduce the character who I think George Romero intends as the audience's entry into the world of the Renaissance Fair, which is the girl... The
Patricia Tallman character.
Who says far out every 5 minutes.
Yeah, far out.
Her name is like Lucy or something? Or...
Lisa. It's something very simple like that.
Or Julie. I think her name is Julie.
And she looks like she just showed up from the 1950s with that... Yeah. Like some sort of like... kerchief in her hair or something.
This movie is
wearing like a pink sweater.
It's kind of out of time even for 81 in some of how it's doing some things. She shows up with her mom and her dad.
And her dad's being a jerk.
Her dad is being a huge jerk.
But he goes from, it's bizarre because he goes from being like some just goofy fat guy who eats a lot and is a slob to then being like literally like a wife beater and like this really angry, mean person. But you don't like... It's like at one time you think he's just this, like...
The subtle hand of George Romero.
Well, there are so many characters in this, and none of them are really...
Why don't we introduce them all at this point anyway, right? Because this jousting sequence...
Oh, my God, Jack.
Seems to introduce them all.
I'm not kidding. There are, like, 45 characters who, like, in this we could not introduce. We're not even able to introduce all of them in this podcast.
Well, there's... What's the main blonde protagonist guy's name?
Okay, so
it's
you
like
have
Dave or something, right?
Alan.
Alan is like a youngish
knight.
He's doing his thing, and he like bumps into literally with his motorcycle Patricia Tallman, Julie, and then immediately they get together, and she gets on the back of his motorcycle because he has to go find Ed Harris.
Yeah, because Julie is like, she calls her dad out of, like, again, you don't really get to set any of these characters up. Like, out of nowhere, she basically explodes, and she's like, Dad, you're a big fat slob. And she, like, runs off and now is riding around with Alan, who is a knight. And the knights in this Renaissance fair ride motorcycles and joust at each other.
Yes.
With...
Like you do.
Like you do. As we see so often.
Yeah. This is historically accurate.
And they have to go off and find Ed Harris because the cops have shown up before the jousting match to shut down the show unless they pay him off.
And they're looking to be paid off, yeah.
This storyline is bananas. Like,
when it pays off at the end.
Because the cops show up and a couple of concepts. So to set it up a little bit, when we say, like, guys are getting on motorcycles to joust, like, they are riding at each other full speed, swinging at each other with weapons on these motorcycles. And then so the cops show up and they're like, hey, we have a permit to do this and we have insurance. At which point I paused. I'm like, whoa, you have insurance? Who insured this?
It was like, the 80s. It was a different time.
Yeah, you know. That's the science fiction in this movie.
There you go.
So the cops are just basically looking to get paid off.
Right.
And so Ed Harris comes riding back in, and he refuses to pay him off. And Morgan, the Tom Savini character, was...
sort of an antagonist for the king.
Kind of?
Yeah. It's
antagonist, towards the end of the movie. Antagonist slash maybe best friend?
Because in the beginning of the movie, he's a protagonist. Frenemy. And then later on, he becomes the antagonist somehow.
And then he comes back,
But he's like, no, just pay him off. We have money. Just give him some money so he'll go away. And Ned Harris is like, wait, we refuse to do this and blah, 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 and leave because we have our permits and whatever.
We got our code that we live by.
Yeah.
And so the cops leave. And, of course, they're going to come back at some point. But
So the cops – right. This is great work not raising the stakes and not delivering something.
Yeah.
The cop shows up threatening to shut them down. Ed Harris is like, he's not going to shut us down. Does not shut them down, leaves.
You're right.
Like, what?
A king outranks a sheriff's deputy.
This is where you meet the doctor, too, because the cop's like, you don't even have any medical personnel here. And he's like, well, that guy's a doctor. And his
Merlin.
Guy.
He's covered in butterfly tattoos.
I want to say, when Merlin first showed up, now, I watched The Shining just a few weeks ago, too.
I thought it was Scatman Carruthers.
Yes. For a brief moment, I'm like, oh, Scatman Carruthers is in this? This is even better than I expected. And then I realized about 2 seconds in, it's just a guy that looks
I thought the same thing. I was like, please be Scatman Carruthers.
I noticed this movie had a lot of actors that I kind of considered poor man actors, like Alan. I can't even think of the actor he looks like. I can't think of his name, but it looks like the guy who played Deckard in Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Oh, yeah, yeah, he looks like a poor man's Stephen Collins.
Yes. Collins.
You had poor man's Scatman Carruthers, and then poor man's Penny Marshall with the mechanic.
Yes!
Like,
yes.
I seriously kept on thinking it was Penny Marshall.
Yeah. And later on, we'll get even more of those start coming in.
Oh, yeah.
So then the jousting begins, and we get a pretty entertaining cameo from Stephen King.
It blew my mind when he popped up.
Yeah, like, Stephen King is like just in a couple of shots.
He's basically playing almost the same character he was playing in Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah,
a dumb guy who's...
You know what? For the sake of argument, let's put both movies in the same canon and say that he is the same character that he was playing.
They could be happening in the same universe.
Well, it's funny because I kept cutting back. Like, I thought it was like a one-shot thing where he's like, yeah, I'm a fake, but they keep cutting back to him during the jousting scene.
He's like noshing on a hot dog and spitting the food chunks out. It's fake. It's fake.
And he's pretty funny. I liked his stuff in this. So we get like our first real joust where two guys go at each other. A guy gets violently knocked off his motorcycle. The motorcycle goes off into the crowd.
The guy tackles it.
Renaissance workers are like trying to tackle him. I'm like, this is the most dangerous thing I've ever seen in my life.
And that's why you can't get anything like that insured ever again.
I know.
It was a pilot program.
Well, I love too. Like every single time someone gets knocked off a motorcycle, they get up and they're holding their elbow. Like, oh.
Yeah, everyone has A team. Reactions to like after the crashes,
man. There are some violent crashes.
Oh yeah,
too.
Some of I was like, oh my god, when I saw them.
The crash Tom Savini take, the bike flips over, just goes head first in the ground.
When they
cut back, it's like you should not be standing up right now.
Yeah, everyone was paralyzed.
I got a concussion just watching that.
I'm gonna just to skip forward for a second. Later on in the movie, they introduce the Renaissance Fair's lawyer, and I was like, this should be a movie about him. I can only imagine. What kind of stuff he's dealing with.
Drinking himself into an early grave. What did I get into with these guys?
I know. We also find out there's a female knight.
She's like gay, isn't she?
They kind of imply that.
Yeah, there's
which
like
is an important. There's this whole thing with another guy who's gay, and she's kind of like, well, it works for me or something.
One of the many messages of the film is, of course, a message of tolerance. And there is one character who is gay and he's not sure, and he's having trouble fitting in. And then there's a scene where they out him and he feels all upset.
Which is the most bizarre scene.
Which makes no sense because they're already an accepting group. Yeah, he just kind of gets over it.
Nobody really seems to give him any trouble about it.
I would actually say this is...
They kind of just want him to admit it to himself.
Like, a compliment I would pay to this movie is this movie's treatment of homosexuality for 1981 is pretty good, pretty advanced. Like, it's very accepting, and it kind of actually looks at the idea of, you know, will other people be more accepting and self-denial? Like, and it's a really surprisingly mature take. I think George Romero is always kind of like
with Night of the Living Dead having, you know, a black main actor. He was kind of forward with that kind of thing, too. So I think he's always been sort of...
Yeah. I guess
forward
that's true.
And tolerant with his films.
In such a weird movie, I was really like almost taken aback by how mature that the take on that was.
Yeah.
But I did like when the female knight wins, and just so that the audience member at home knows that this is a big deal, you get a random sound effect of someone being like, "Far out!" Like, you're like, "Oh, okay, thanks for punctuating that," you know, in editing, George.
Groovy.
And then, okay, and this is really weird. So then Tom Savini has built this new weapon that he wants to use in jousting.
It's like a mace.
Metal club.
It's like a straight-up club, which even the other people at the Renaissance Fair are like, whoa.
Wait a second, dude.
Like, we are doing the most dangerous thing in the world, and this is too dangerous for us. And
you might have taken a little too far.
And he wants to use it because some of the battles, sometimes it's like people on a motorcycle jousting, and sometimes it's people in like kind of like a standing sidecar. I'd almost describe it as.
It's like if there's no clear winner of the joust, they go to these. I can't remember what they called them. These other motorcycles, the sidecars, where they have like hand weapons, and now they have to try to knock each other out.
Yeah, it's almost like the motorcycle equivalent of like a cart. You know, if a horse was like pulling a cart, I guess.
Yeah.
And So there's all this like conversation of like, oh, is Tom Savini going to get to use his club, you know, his or his mace? Can he use his mace? Meanwhile, the other guy is lining up with a straight up axe.
Like, what? Really? They do point out before
they're worried about the
head.
Mace, and then you get an axe coming.
Whoa!
They do point out it's a rubber head a little earlier in the movie, but
I guess,
it's
but like, wow. All right,
well, they are also sawing the lances a little bit so that they break easier. Yeah. So they're implying that they're. They're kind of half-assing it because they want
to
put on
their insurance
good show.
Demands it.
Right.
Yeah. But then he's got a straight-up just mace.
Right. Well, and then, okay, so
he wins against this hand battle.
Tom Savini does, right?
Yeah, and then he, like, challenges the king.
Yeah, and then...
So Ed Harris, even though his girlfriend's like, no, you really shouldn't do that, he's like, I'm going to do it. So he gets on his motorcycle and puts on his goofy hat, and he kind of gives the nod to. Oh no, this was earlier. He gave the nod for him to use the mace.
He gives him the mace, and the funniest thing is everyone knows about this crazy Tom Savini mace, except for the guy who's about to get a concussion from it. That guy did not know about it. This is news to him when he gets boshed with it, like right upside the head. But then Ed Harris decides he's going to join the joust.
Yeah, and so he's facing off against Tom Savini. And it's weird because even someone points out later, it's like he's trying to lose.
Yeah.
He's got a death wish almost.
Yeah, or... he's not doing a very good job. And Tom Savini knocks him off his bike with his, I think it was the mace again, isn't it?
Hits
him in like the neck with the mace, and he goes flying off the bike.
Yeah.
And he's got like a huge gash in his neck.
Causing
like
an injury in Ed Harris's neck that, depending on what's going on in the plot of the movie, is either devastating or not a big deal.
Yeah. But then all of a sudden, doesn't everybody take the field? So like,
well,
they
have to rescue him.
To rescue
right,
the
because
king.
If he yields, then Tom Savini will be king, and this is the point where all the other knights immediately take it just as seriously as Ed Harris.
Yes, they take it, and somebody throws a mace into Tom Savini's wheel.
Yes,
he goes, which I'm like, whoa!
This is LARPing taken to dangerous extremes.
Yeah, that... should have gotten a concussion. Flies right into the ground.
He should
at 30
not
miles
be alive.
No.
really, like, I'm still thinking of this scene and, like, and Tom Savini's like, ah, all right, well, I lost that one. I'm like, lost that one? You're lucky to be alive. and the king is hurt. So one of the better laughs in the movie is someone's like, get a stretcher, and they come out with an old-timey like stretcher.
Yeah.
Which I don't know why
they can ride motorcycles, but they can't have a modern day stretcher.
Yeah, it's like made of like just cloth, like cloth.
So then I have
and,
expected
like, tree
I have expected they were gonna bust out the leeches and start bleeding this guy.
Right. So this is where they fully give you the idea that the premise of this movie is that the business workings of this Renaissance fair are legitimately being decided by motorcycle jousts.
Yeah.
And that people who come and watch this aren't just watching jousts. This is almost like watching a corporate takeover, you know, in the world of George Romero.
But if you fail the corporate takeover, you have infinite number of tries to do it again.
Yes.
So then at the end of the joust, they have like this just open event where anybody with a motorcycle can come up and participate.
Also, how is this insured?
They did have to sign waivers.
Okay.
But
they do make a point of showing them signing waivers.
But of course, since it's motorcyclists, you know, biker gangs, they go
one of them with a swastika carved into his forehead, no less.
They
very
they,
subtle.
They steal all the lances and all the weapons and they go riding off and so some of the Renaissance
the woman leads,
fair
the female
guys
knight leads
to,
a crusade to get them back.
They have to go out and chase him down. And but I only mentioned it because there's something funny when I think it's her. She chases one guy down.
Oh, the one with the swastika.
Is it him?
Yes, it is.
Where he like she knocks him off his bike or something.
Like
and,
he jumps off.
Yeah,
before
he,
she
oh,
can
she's
hit
like
him
coming
with...
at him with the lance. Yeah, and he jumps off. And the bike like rolls into a field and then just explodes.
Explodes! Yeah. It explodes like it's in a like a Schwarzenegger movie.
That's one of my favorite things in the movies when vehicles just explode from nowhere.
Apparently his bike is powered by jet fuel.
And apparently the bike was just made of fuel.
Luckily those bikes flying at the crowd during the joust weren't like exploding like that too.
Yeah.
So so they get all the weapons back and they go back to the camp.
And mixed in there too, we touched on them earlier. So the Renaissance Fair's doctor is a guy who's known as Merlin.
He used to be a real doctor, but then he left the real world to join the commune and to dress like a wizard and give fortunes and perform medical treatments on idiots who hurt themselves while jousting on motorcycles.
Pretty accurate. I would never be able to do it justice, but you need to see this movie when he sings a song slash does beat poetry about King Arthur with a harmonica as Ed Harris is apparently bleeding out in a trailer. In a movie full of surreal moments, that is near the top of the list. This wound that Ed Harris takes is kind of like hangs over a lot of the rest of the movie. Is he hurt? How badly is he hurt? I don't know. In fact, by the end of the movie, I'm still not clear.
At the end, it's like the worst wound ever. He's like still bleeding, and it leads to the most bizarre ending ever. But
yeah.
But during most of the movie, it's okay. He's stitched up. And
other people were coming in, kind of like this queen is kind of like, people were basically being like, hey, you know, you got to stop being so suicidal.
Yeah.
You know, he's essentially like slightly less suicidal than Mel Gibson in the first Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
I want to mention too, because it comes back at the end and it's amazing, how after the joust, some kid comes up to him.
This is great.
And yes, this is important.
He's got like a bike, like a dirt bike magazine or something.
Yeah.
Like, and it's got a picture of, or it's got maybe like an article on this trip.
Billy Davis.
Yes. Yeah, he's like, Billy Davis, you're the king. He's like, can you sign this picture? And apparently Billy Davis, Ed Harris, didn't know that this was in this magazine. And he refuses to sign it. Cause
that's all Evel Knievel crap, man. Yeah, this isn't me.
He's not about magazines and publicity, so he
Stallone
wouldn't.
Stallone is apparently playing Billy Davis all of a sudden.
Yeah. Just be glad he's not doing like a Russian accent.
I'm off today. My voices are off.
So he refuses to sign it, and he walks away. And the kid's like, oh, that guy's a jerk.
And then
Tom Savini's like, oh, I'll sign it for you, kid.
And like a nice guy.
Yeah. So at this point, Tom Savini's like the good guy. I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Which by the end of the movie, I kind of thought, I think Tom Savini was right throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like he's the one guy that's not. He's the one guy who I think is taking this as seriously as it should be taken.
Right. Yeah.
Just like, we're just screwing around, right?
Right.
And Tom Savini, who also seems legitimately interested in the fact of like, yeah, we do need to make a living from this.
Right.
So that involves either money or bartering for goods and services.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, which leads to, the greatest line of dialogue in the movie. When Ed Harris turns the kid down and his queen is like, hey, easy, you know, easy spaz. You know, you could have signed an autograph for that kid. And, you know, she's like, oh, actually, it's one of the queen's only bits of dialogue in the whole movie. And she's like, he just sees you as a hero. And Ed Harris, channeling the acting of George C. Scott, is like, I'm not trying to be a hero. I'm trying to fight the dragon. At which point, I have seen this movie. I am still not sure if Ed Harris was talking about a literal or a figurative dragon.
He had just kicked heroin.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what he was referring to. Yeah. In fact, for a lot of the movie, I still kind of thought either a literal or figurative dragon was going to show up in the movie. Throughout
the whole thing, I found myself asking, does he really think he's a king of... Like, I'm not sure by the end.
He sure acts like it.
Yeah.
He
dresses it, too, even in his off time. Never noticed that in scenes where the bikers are off doing their own thing? Like, they're not in the Renaissance Fair. Like, it's their off time. They're wearing, like leather leggings and, like... You know, like handmade, like peasant shirts, like they
they've still got like a medieval thing going on.
Yeah.
But still using fully cool with using modern things. Like they're driving around like modern vans and like buses and you know, they have a high tech
and motorcycles.
Motorcycles, a high tech
audio system.
It's commonly
referred to as a steel horse. Bon Jovi sang about it one time.
One of the better shots in the movie is Ed Harris in his full on like Renaissance Fair outfit working a very like high end like audio system, audio booth system. And you're
I used to come into work dressed like that.
That's right. As anyone.
I got
could.
Some editing to do, clank, clank, clank.
Where's my mace?
smash cut.
So the cops come back, and then they're like, you know, and the Renaissance people are like, do you have a warrant? The cop just pulls out a gun. They're like, oh, all right, come on in.
Good enough.
Ed Harris still won't pay the bribe.
Well, he breaks into Bagman, I think is his name, his trailer, and they, I don't know, I still know if they planted the weed or if it was actually Bagman's weed, but they say, oh, look what we find here. You're coming with us. And Ed Harris comes over, and he's like, you're freaking out.
Yeah.
He's like,
we're not paying your bribe.
Yeah.
I'll go to jail.
Okay.
So, and the cop's like, all right, that's cool. So they
Let's
take
go.
Ed Harris and another Renaissance Fair guy to jail. Cut to cop brutally beating. I mean, this guy
just
is getting
massacring
beat.
The hell out of this
Absolutely.
Guy.
Taylor Lautner fighting his dad in abduction looks gentle compared to this scene.
Yes.
Yeah, it was pretty brutal.
And like,
well,
Ed
this
Harris,
shows this is the first scene that really shows like Ed Harris's true, like, thinking he's like a king. He really is like hurting to watch this guy get beat up.
Yeah.
Like, he's like reaching his hand to the bars like, stop it. Like, he's freaking out.
Yep.
You know, he suffers for his men. You know, he's a king.
He will not pay a cent, though, to keep them from getting beat up.
Of course not. Of course not. Well, you know, you got to pick your battles.
And then they somehow get out of the... Somehow they get out of the jail, and as they're leaving, like, a bunch of Renaissance Fair guys have to, like,
hold
Ed Harris
back. Well, because Alan and Patricia Tallman go and find the sheriff.
Okay.
And, in the middle of the night.
Yeah, they show up to his house in the middle of the night, and they're asking his wife where he is, and it's a really weird scene, but... They end up finding him off screen, and he comes in and he's like, why did you arrest these people? They had permission to be, you know, they had permits and stuff, and you're trying to get money out of them. So he makes them release Ed Harris and Bagman.
Okay.
And that's when Ed Harris tries to attack the cop right in front of the sheriff, and he's like, I'm coming back for you, man. I'm coming back for you.
And we should, I just like to clarify at this point, the movie is based a lot on this, like, I'm sure George Romero sees it, and it's trying to be a modern day retelling of Arthurian legend. So a lot of characters are lining up with kind of like Camelot. Like, Ed Harris is King Arthur. This woman who he's with, who I don't even know if her name is ever given, is clearly
Guinevere.
This Alan character is
Lancelot.
Is Lancelot, although he doesn't do anything Lancelot. Like, there's a Merlin character, you know, the...
Named
Doctor, it's actually named Merlin. That one's pretty on the nose. Actually, yeah, yeah. It really didn't even make that subtle. And later on, like other, kind of Arthurian legend representations come in. And one of the things why I know people think it's cool, but it's also one of the issues I have with the movie is if you are not very familiar with Arthurian legend, a lot of this movie will not make any sense.
Right.
Especially the final, I would say. 15 to 20 minutes would make 0.0 sense if you are not intimately familiar with, you know, that the whole story. And not just even like the Walt Disney, like Sword in the Stone version, like the actual, like, real, like,
maybe that's why
once
I had no
in future
what was going
king
on for most of this movie.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. I don't know. I guess kudos for being very true to, like, you know, real Arthurian legend and not caring. Like, if people, like, it's almost like Romero saying, like, if you don't know Arthurian legend, I don't want you seeing a movie. Get out! Okay, so now the movie's moving, it's going forward, and some TV people are like,
well, they interested. They go on to the next town. Ed Harris is still left behind in the other town because he's in jail. So they get to the next town, and they find out that the lawyer, who is in another town, set up this thing with this entertainment guy and some TV people.
They can make money off of this. Make it a televised event.
Yeah, he's going to sell it to big venues and stuff.
Apparently, there's like some buzz building in the community about this cool thing that everybody likes to watch.
Right.
So Morgan is all for this because he's basically leading the group at this point.
And he's basically the most logical thinking one.
And he's like, yeah, we should totally do that. We can make some money and whatever. And
yeah, he's like, hey, we need money. You know, like, we're smashing. We're apparently
someone's
going to
sue us at some point.
I know. People will take us seriously.
Our insurance policy costs $1 million a year. And that's only for $500,000 of protection.
So basically everyone there is up for this. They're all like, yeah, we should probably be making money on this because it's kind of getting old not making money off of this.
But not Ed Harris, who
Ed Harris isn't there yet. When he gets there... Oh, no, on the way there, they take a break, and they camp out in the woods, and that's when...
They cross paths with the lawyer.
And that's when the lawyer tells him about this whole thing, and he's very, very upset about it.
And so then we get... And this is where the movie gets really idealistic, which is kind of cool, but also just very weird, where Ed Harris kind of goes on this whole kick of, like, the truth is our code, and... I just spent last night with a guy who got his head beat in for our code, and you can't have a Knights of the Round Table meeting without me here. And
But then the guy who had his head beat in is like, no, you're wrong about that. We should totally
get
some money.
Yeah, dude, seriously, we
you
need
gotta
some
survive.
Money.
I'm going to have hospital bills soon.
Don't use me as an excuse because
I've got a concussion. You know, it's...
And in the midst of this, Ed Harris just picks up a pizza, walks about 100 yards with it, and then throws it in the face of one of the TV guys.
Played by Gennaro from Jurassic Park for about 5 minutes. I'm there going, where have I seen this guy?
Yes. And this guy's even like, hey.
He's like, I didn't buy this pizza.
Yeah. I didn't even bring this pizza.
I don't like anchovies.
Yeah. And this is where the movie kind of struggles a bit for me, because it's very idealistic in that there's this whole like way of life and this like, and they actually have a character who comes on and goes, "Hey, this isn't just a roadside carnival. It's more, a lot more." And I'm like, "Is it though? I'll take your word for that." I'm not sure it is.
Well, yeah, it's like the group is basically like breaking up into two different factions, like one that thinks they should go with this guy and the other who thinks they should stick with what they're doing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of this fight, they're basically going to break up. At the end of this joust or whatever.
A lot of the
next show.
A lot of the knights and like the support staff are kind of going in two different directions.
They're kind of losing confidence in the king. They're kind of thinking, well, maybe we could make money off of this, or you know what, I want to get back. This is fun as long as it lasted, but I've got a life I want to lead.
Yeah, and then there's others who just leave. Like Alan just leaves. He doesn't go with either of them.
Right.
So it's like
he has a great line. I think it's in here where he's like, "Hey man, I just need some time to think," and everyone's like, and I kept thinking like someone else was gonna say something, and just no one says anything. It just is like, okay, yeah, all right, well, see ya, you know.
All right,
yeah. And there is one more kind of like they do one more like joust section where like. Somehow modern music, like this is kind of like the big.
Well, everyone's basically
giving
up, yeah.
Yeah, and like modern music gets put on at one point. Yeah. Ed Harris,
he will have none of that.
Yeah, he has to go in there and turn it off. There's
the gay guy who's the announcer is like, I don't know if he's conflicted or what, but he's like, at one point he's walking away, and then Ed Harris is like, "Will you get back up there?" And he's like, "Yeah, okay." So it's like, I guess he sticks with Ed Harris at that point, but he's ready to walk away too, and
he's very frustrated. And in another one of these incredibly violent jousting scenes. We'd earlier in the movie seen a bike kind of go into the crowd and a bunch of people to jump on it. This time,
I laughed so hard at this.
A bike full
because
blown
I'm a monster.
Goes into the crowd, hits a woman.
Almost hits like a baby in a stroller.
Almost, there is blood everywhere. It is heavily implied that this woman is seriously injured, if not near death.
Yeah.
Never touched on again.
And then one of the guys, well, later on, someone says like, "Oh, she's okay. She'll live."
I didn't even hear that.
Someone said that to her.
There's no way she's okay.
But some like one of the guys picks up the baby, and everyone cheers like, "Oh, the baby's okay," and the woman's still like bleeding on the ground over here,
like looking terrible.
Get the stretcher.
Oh, get the old timey stretcher.
So this is like just that represents the whole thing crumbling, I guess. And
right.
That's when everyone kind of splits off into their own.
And we get one of, there's probably, I would say, I stopped keeping track, but I'd say there's roughly 725 shots of the Queen character just looking sad/nervous in this movie.
It's confused.
Whenever they were in the editing room, I feel like whenever something was going wrong in editing and they're like, "Where do we go from here?" They're like, "Insert shot of Queen looking concerned."
Like, you probably could have cut it down to 2 hours if you took out the concerned shots of her.
Yeah,
you probably could.
And was it during this battle where the Indian guy comes in?
Yes.
Where he just, like, comes...
Yes. Well, now, this is important because Ed Harris, at the beginning of the movie, has a vision of a black bird, a raven, while he's smacking himself and bathing in the river or whatever. And then later on, he asks Merlin about it. He's scared. He got felled by Morgan or whatever, and he's nervous and scared. So he says, "Tell me, wizard, you know, what's this prophecy of the black bird?" And he says, "Beware the black bird. It could bring about your demise."
But Merlin doesn't say it in that way. Merlin's like, "Hey, man, there's some trippy stuff going down out in the freaky deaky world. Watch out for that crazy bird with the flapping wings. Catch you later, dog."
Then they go through, when they first arrive in this next town, they do a parade through town to kind of promote the show. And there's this kid who's like a Native American kid with like long hair is just kind of like staring at them in the crowd. They purposely zoom in on him. They don't mention him for like another 20 minutes. Then he shows up at this joust in this scene.
Like some homemade armor.
Specifically, they show he's got a black bird painted on his armor. When Ed Harris sees that, he's got to joust him.
Yes. So Ed Harris jousted him, does manage to beat him. though maybe re-injures his neck wound, question mark? I don't know what.
I think they keep implying this, but here's the thing that I thought was ridiculous. The bird is supposed to, like, bring
the
about...
The one ridiculous thing. I don't...
Yeah.
More ridiculous. One okay. more ridiculous thing. We'll say that. He jousts the blackbird, I guess, if you want to call him that. He wins, and then later on, his shoulder wound that was reopened and all that, no, he's just fine. He's just been mended. He's sitting in the trailer with the guy who's the blackbird, and everything is cool.
What was
the point of the ominous foretelling of the...
This is where the Romero's use of Arthurian stuff comes in, because the guy, the Indian who had the bird, is playing Percival, like the role of Percival Arthurian legend, who then is kind of becomes... King Arthur's squire, which is why he's then kind of with Arthur the rest of the movie. But this, again, if you don't know this, you'd be like, what is going on?
Yeah.
I mean, even it's been at least 10 years since I read The Once and Future King, and I had to go on Wikipedia while I was watching this movie being like, okay, wait, hold on. Like, where are we going with this? Yeah, I need some cliff notes.
I don't know anything about Arthurian legend, so to me it was just, why is this guy here?
Right.
Why did he have to fight him? I didn't catch any of the
Why was this
stuff.
Guy foretelling his doom, but then he fights him and everything's okay?
And he's now his assistant. He's basically the Robin to his Batman for the rest of the movie.
And he has no name and he has no lines.
Right.
So
or no interaction with any other character, by the way.
At one point I'm like, Is this guy real? Like, I thought, like, he was, like...
Just a fever dream of Ed
Harris's. Yeah, like, only he was seeing that. And that's why everyone was like, what are you doing when he's going out to fight him?
Right.
Like, maybe this is just, like, some vision he's having. And at the end, you find out he's not actually there. But no.
Still, actually, that could be true
actually,
now that I think about
still
it.
Still a possibility. I'm telling you, everything Ed Harris said after the I'm fighting the dragon moment made me question if he was in our reality.
So, Morgan has gone off and he's... now in a pool.
Oh boy!
At his new girlfriend's
Morgan
house.
Has signed the contract, and he's about to go famous.
He has gone Hollywood. Literally, he has literally gone to Hollywood.
He's got his shirt off. Yeah,
he's drinking scotch.
He's
swimming.
He's with his new girlfriend because his old girlfriend is the mechanic.
Oh yeah, he was
cheating Penny on Marshall. Her apparently, or is he?
And so now he's like banging this other girl who's got a husband or a boyfriend, and he's got this house, and it's all confusing.
But basically, it's just showing him
that he's gone Hollywood.
Right. We do get to see Tom Savini in a Speedo, which people have been clamoring for.
ever since his cameo in Dawn of the Dead, it was a big talk.
So, but
and at the same time, Alan and Patricia Tallman are at some other guy's house, and they're just kind of hanging out, talking.
This scene
because she's been hanging with him the whole time,
right?
At this point, this like they have a romance building up here.
What I mean in this scene, because Alan, who I'm Lancelot doing some air quotes because again, this is Lancelot by default, is off with Julie and like another guy from the Renaissance Fair
who
you don't know his name. Who again, they're kind of implying is Lancelot's squire. You have no reason to think that if you're just watching this movie out of context.
Yeah.
They go and have a dialogue scene where they just have like lunch with a couple of random characters who maybe used to be in the Renaissance Fair.
Yeah.
And it's just straight up filler. Like there's nothing happens in it. They just had to get like Lancelot on his own. They had to get Tom Savini on his own and they had to get Ed Harris on his own.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, okay, we did that. Now we can move the movie forward. But you're like,
And after the scene, which is the most baffling thing in this movie, is
which is saying something.
Yeah, to me at least, is that he decides for some reason that he can't hang out with Patricia Tallman anymore.
Mm. Yes,
he's like, okay, we've done this, we're done. So he takes her back to her house
with her.
Oh yeah.
Which earlier in the movie they were at her house and they saw her mother and she was all bruised up in the face and it's obvious. She said, like, Dad did that to you, didn't he?
Yeah.
So it's obvious this guy's abusive. And she ran away with this other guy, so obviously he's going to be angry. So he drops her off at the house.
Hey, good luck with that. See you later.
He's like, I'm going to go.
Let me ask you a question, because they really laid a fair amount of, like, pipe in the beginning of this movie to set up that. Oh, yeah. They really set that up that the dad is violent.
Right.
And in two different scenes, they show him being violent and abusive to his own family.
Yes.
They wrap that storyline up, right?
Basically. This is what happens.
That's clarified, right?
It's nighttime.
With a shallow grave.
He leaves. Yeah. She sits on the stoop. the light in the house turns on behind her, and she goes, "Oh shit." And that's the end.
That's it.
You're left to assume.
She may be dead.
You're left to assume that he beat the crap out of her, maybe killed her, and that's the end of her character. And this is like the third act of the movie by
never,
now.
That's some real chivalrous behavior there on the part of...
Never referenced again.
So what's what facet of the Arthurian legend is she supposed to represent?
It
was like I was...
Lancelot sowing his wild oats.
At the end of this movie, I'm like, how do they not bring her back anywhere? Like, she literally... The end of her arc was she got beaten by her father for running away with a guy in a Renaissance
fair. And why would you even put in the scenes establishing how violent her father was if you're not going to pay that off?
And why was she in this movie if she did nothing besides
say far out
make her father angry?
Also a great question.
She wasn't his love interest at any point beyond this.
No,
this she wasn't.
And you really
part of the group. She didn't like become part of the group. Or
and I would even make the case that she didn't even really work with the intention of she's the audience's guide into this world of Renaissance fairs, because that really wasn't even that successful.
She didn't do a lot of guiding.
Yeah,
right. She didn't do anything that affected anything in this movie.
Right.
It was bizarre. The end of this arc was bizarre to me.
And meanwhile, Tom Savini is learning, hey, wait a second. Hollywood is not cool, guys.
Well, there's this bizarre photo shoot scene where he's like dressed like a half-naked Power Ranger.
You
like...
say bizarre. I say inspiring.
Yeah.
It was like the...
I know what I'm going as for Halloween.
It was almost as bizarre as the photo shoot scene in the canyons.
Maybe, yeah. Just
it
as
was
disturbing.
Certainly just as uncomfortable.
He was just as upset to be there.
And he sees like all the, like just these like
fake.
Ugly. Basically, Tom Savini experiences the canyons. Yeah. I didn't even think of it that way. He experiences the canyons. He's like, we gotta get out of here.
Yeah, and he's there with the Friar Tuck character, who's getting it on with the documentary photographer, who we'll see a lot more of later.
Yeah,
we've already seen quite a bit of her at this point. Actually,
we have. That's very true.
So, after some big fight scene that happens in a hotel room with everyone, and again, he's like, this isn't cool.
So
Ellen and his nameless squire come riding in as he's like sitting on a curb all sad, like, oh, I made a mistake.
And then he stands up and he actually like has this look of hope on his face.
Yeah. And they're like,
there are so
they
many,
say something bizarre.
Right after they drop the Julie character off too. They're like right up
there. Yeah.
There was a lot of times in this movie where all I could think of was Arrested Development and a character being like, I've made a terrible mistake.
That's it. I want to remake this with Will Arnett.
Yeah.
I've made a terrible mistake.
But Tom Savini...
I forgot a line that happened earlier. I should have
said. Let's bring it up.
So, going back a while, during the last joust before everyone leaves, the gay announcer guy is announcing this whole thing, and everything's going crazy. And there's this other guy who apparently is gay. You don't know until this point. And he goes, if we get out of this alive, will you be my lover?
Yes!
It's like, yes! Over the intercom. It was like the most bizarre thing ever.
The timing of that was very odd.
It was like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Everything about that was really odd. That's how you ask someone out.
I mean, because then they end up being a couple friends in the movie. But it was just like this funny, like,
which again, because they handled that, like, this guy's sexuality so maturely earlier, and then like Romero goes for like a cheap laugh almost with it. And I was like, oh, it's so
right.
It's one of the only like attempts at a cheap laugh in the movie, and I'm like, really a strange and upsetting point to go for that.
So.
Oh, and we should say, by the way, Tom Savini, who is coming back, does take his new motorcycles and costumes that Hollywood has provided.
They look like they made a styrofoam.
He somehow gets some kind of an army.
They look. I don't.
I think it's all the guys who went with him, but they all have their own.
They all their own.
Like some serious money was spent getting them costumes and bikes, and they're just like, screw you guys in Hollywood.
We're out of here.
And they're supposed to look cool.
They do not.
They do not look cool.
No.
They look like a
sad
bad...
Power Rangers extras.
Yes, yes.
There's like a 5-minute scene of them riding through country roads in their terrible styrofoam costumes.
Yes, and there's this triumphant like horn music like bum 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 ba dum bum, like as they're riding.
Yeah, it's like Power Rangers Renaissance edition. Yeah.
And they're riding back to the town of the last... event, which is where Ed Harris has kept the troop because he expects them to come back.
Right.
Everyone's like, shouldn't we go on to the next town?
And there is one scene that, like we were saying earlier, there are some moments that are so sincere that it does make it very endearing. And there's one where, I can't remember who asks Ed Harris, like, well, what are we going to do?
The guy with the guitar,
We're just going to wait for them to come back. However long it takes.
There's a line where Ed Harris goes, we wait.
Yeah.
And then the movie actually just shows them
waiting.
Like, I'm like, whoa. Like, that, again, what a bold choice by Romero.
Something from the something I want to mention from Battle of the Year that I can't mention now because we're on that episode. We should talk about that later. Tom Savini comes riding back in with Alan and all the other jousters.
And there's this kind of moment where it's like, the band is back together.
Ed Harris is again in the pond, like, I don't know what he's doing. He's just naked in the pond
whipping
again.
Whipping himself.
We have not gotten enough shots of Ed Harris's ass yet.
Yeah.
They had a quota to fill.
No. Yes. We need one more. And when someone, I think it's like Tuck, yells from over the hill, like, hey, there's some guys here for you, or whatever. And he gets out of the water, and that's when Tom Savini and the rest of them are back. And he's like so happy to see him.
And they sort of have this conference between Alan and Tom Savini and Ed Harris where I'm going to summarize it, but they basically come out and say, hey, you know what? If we're cool with not killing each other, I think we can continue doing this. But no killing. You know? Well, to which Ed Harris is like all smiles like, yeah.
Well, then it's kind of decided here that Alan will be Ed Harris's champion.
Yes.
And there'll be a battle between, I guess, both sides completely. Like, it'll be Morgan and his people and...
Yeah, they'll give Morgan a chance to see if he can... If Morgan can beat Alan's side, then Morgan has a chance to take over leadership of...
Right, yeah, like, he gets to be king.
Because Lancelot and... I used to call him Lancelot. I'm endorsing this concept. But, like, Alan and Tom Savini have a conversation earlier where they're like, there can only be one king. To which point I so wanted Tom Savini to be like, hold on, let me check your math on that. I'm going to do 5, 2, 6, 7 divided by 2. No, you're right. Okay, there can only be one king. You're right. All right.
Numbers check out.
Yep.
Math doesn't lie.
Yeah. So now with rules, apparently the first time rules have been introduced.
No swinging for the head.
Yeah.
No.
And somehow Ed Harris now has come around and he's just accepting whatever happens. If he wins, he's still king. If he loses, he's not the king.
He's decided that maybe this is his time to go, but he wants a fighting chance at least.
He's fine with whatever outcome.
Whatever outcome. And we get a huge... There's a lot. We're not really touching on it that much because it's more like action scenes. But like, there's just already been a ton of freaking motorcycle jousting in this, and now we get another long, big action sequence.
That's probably the longest one.
This is probably the longest one of the two sides, you know, kind of meeting on the battlefield and tons of jousting.
There's a bizarre thing here too, which I don't think they needed. Someone like runs someone else off their bike, or whatever, and he like tumbles off into the behind like the tents or whatever. And then it's like a 30 or 45 second shot of this guy like driving back down his motorcycle, picking the guy up. He gets on the back of the bike. He drives him back to the battlefield, and then the guy gets off the bike, and then the bike goes back into battle.
They're like, fighting, but they're still friends.
Yeah, like
they got to establish that these guys are still friends.
It was a very procedural thing. Yeah, like we're all sitting at home, being like, I wonder what happened to that guy.
Meanwhile, we're still wondering what the hell happened to Patricia Tallman. Is she dead?
She's in a hospital.
And so we're getting all this like fighting and like maces swinging and like clubs and we constantly are cutting back to cutaways of Ed Harris. There's about 50 cutaways of Ed Harris smiling like it is the greatest thing he's
giddy.
Ever
there
seen.
There is no other way to describe it but
he's
giddy.
He's loving it.
The family's back together.
Yeah, we're all fighting each other on motorcycles
he's stopping
with dangerous
just sort of
weapons.
Clapping. He's so excited.
Oh, don't you love it, honey? Anybody could die at any moment. This is great. And at one point, a bike runs into a station wagon in one of the bigger laps, I think, in the movie.
He runs in the station wagon, he goes flying over the station wagon, and then the other guy like picks him up and brings him back.
Right. And it kind of, I mean, just to move forward, I mean, this is a long, long sequence. The Alan Lancelot character does go down in possibly the most anticlimactic moment.
Yeah, he's kind of
almost just falls
off his bike.
He basically just falls. I didn't even understand.
I didn't know he was the last guy standing.
I didn't know he's lost the we're gonna go really inside baseball here. The geography of this scene, this whole sequence is terrible. Yeah. I never knew who it was. Never really clear who was who, what was like at stake, who was down, who was up. Yeah. So like when Lancelot actually gets knocked down, I was still confused for a solid like 2+ minutes afterwards. I'm like, oh, okay, the fight is over then. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In what is supposedly the biggest moment in the movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, so not the best editing by Romero's team.
Yeah. So Tom Savini wins, and Ed Harris gives him the crown.
And then he goes.
Gives him his wife.
Then he goes. Then his wife goes with Alan for no reason.
Yeah, his wife
and
goes with Alan.
That was when I fully realized, like, oh, okay, they are going for a full. Yeah. Arthurian thing here, because there's very little to establish that there's anything going on between. Yeah,
right.
There's concerned looks, but it can always be played off as Billy's kind of crazy, right? He's kind of screwed up in the head.
This is weird, right?
So yeah, because
Ed Harris just walks away. He leaves, and I'm like, wait, he's not staying with the, like, I thought he would stay with the group and be one of the knights, or but he's just like, I'm gone.
We'll also say at this point that Morgan like walks up to the promotions rep and says, you can take that contract and shove it. And everyone's like, Morgan!
The promotions guy should have been like, you know, you signed a contract, right? You know what a contract means, right?
Right.
You can't
just your lawyer around? We should explain this to you.
Which means that his first act as king is he's going to bring a massive lawsuit down upon him.
Well, there was a scene before the fight where the promotions guy, the promoter was like, talking to the lawyer, like, he's going to come with us, right? And he's like, I don't know what he's going to do. And it's like, you should have said, no, you do know because you had him sign this contract.
Right.
You're a lawyer. You should know that this is kind of legally binding. We gave him all these bikes and costumes. He's got to give us something.
We cannot understate how awkward in the pacing of this movie the moment is when the queen, who has really not had any dialogue, not really had any storyline of her own, just kind of stands up and walks over and goes to Alan, two characters who've essentially had no scenes together, and they're just like, okay, we're together now. Yeah. And it's, you know, which if you've seen, Nick, I don't know if you've seen it, it's probably the considered the greatest of the King Arthur movies. And of course, I'm referring to First Knight with Sean Connery and Richard Gere, which brilliantly covers the complexities of the Lancelot-Guinevere Arthur relationship. See it, or actually don't. It's horrendous and maybe on the show any day now. But like in that, there's kind of this like love triangle, and eventually they develop it. Here it's just like we skipped the triangle into a straight line.
We're already at 2.5 hours, guys. We had to cut something.
Yeah.
So yeah, Tom Savini makes the his mechanic girlfriend his queen.
Yeah.
Who the whole movie she's been trying to convince that she's worth it, and she's because she's like down on herself, or whatever, and and now she's the queen.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, I do love her.
Yeah.
And Billy rides off, and we sort of get.
I love this scene coming up.
Well, I was trying to think as I was watching this movie.
At this point on, this is where we could do a whole hour just on the last 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
This is
so bizarre.
And but I just do want to say the scene where, you know, he hands the crown over to Tom Savini, like, it's actually a legitimately kind of touching scene.
It is. Because Savini's learned his lesson, you know? He's got pride issues.
Yeah.
And, like, it's very well acted, and I loved the exchange between Ed Harris and Merlin.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's very kind of touching, and then he just rides off.
Yeah.
And we get to the most bizarre 10 or 15 minutes of film I've ever seen.
If they had actually stopped the movie that could have been the end of the movie. That point.
Yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
As a standalone movie, I would almost have said to them, maybe you should have stopped it there.
But I'm glad they didn't.
But they didn't. I was trying to think at this point. I don't know if Superman 2 had come out when this came out, and maybe Superman 2 was even after it. But the first of many weird things that happens is essentially this movie's version of the Superman 2 ending, where, you know, where Clark Kent goes back into the bar and like beats up that like person who's a jerk to him. Ed Harris walks into a fast food restaurant
dressed like a knight in shining armor.
First off, how does he know where this cop is?
Yeah, I don't know. Walks into like a McDonald's, sees this cop
Bear in mind, the Native American guy who never got any kind of name is kind of following.
Yeah, his squire is with him, and Ed Harris just starts just thrashing this cop. Like
throws his gun in the fryer.
By the way,
it almost turned it was like a.
That is not a good idea to throw a gun into a hot fryer.
No, it's
considering
not.
Guns have gunpowder.
And then for some reason,
yes.
There's a table with like a bowl of tomatoes on it.
It was a different
time. Salad bar.
Yeah.
Like in a McDonald's.
Yeah,
it turns
into like a James Bond chase scene where you have to upset like a vegetable cart.
Well, it was almost like a Goofy's fight scene. You know, he's like pouring ice cream on his face.
He drags the cop into the back of McDonald's and unloads the milkshake machine, like a soft serve ice cream machine on his head.
Beats the hell out of him.
Yeah, and then he throws him into a freezer. And then everyone in the restaurant cheers.
The crowd, the people in the restaurant
because they don't
are
know he's the crooked
nuts.
Cop.
They're watching a guy dressed like a medieval knight.
I would have been terrified.
I would have been scared to death.
I would have been running for a phone to call 911. Like, I don't, there's some psycho here. He's dressed like a knight. He just beat the hell out of a deputy.
And we get the second best fist pump in Stop the Movie podcast history.
Yes.
As Ed Harris walks out. First still goes to Tom Wilkinson in The Lone Ranger. But in second place, it's Ed Harris walking out of a McDonald's after beating up a cop. And Percival, like his squire, is like pulling, like the clerk is ringing up the damage on the cash register. Yeah. And
like they got a button for broken countertop.
Yeah.
Gun in the fryer.
Gun in the fryer.
We haven't had to use that button all week.
And then like the guy's like paying in like coins. I'm like, what are these, what coins are going to be paying for
golden
this?
Golden sovereigns. But then the next part of this finale is my favorite, I think.
Oh boy.
They wake up.
I actually immediately rewind just to watch this again because I'm like, that is what is going on.
It cuts them like in the morning and they're like in the schoolyard.
Yes,
like a one room schoolhouse.
Yeah, and
like.
This is like us. Yeah,
and Ed Harris walks into the schoolhouse.
Yes, here we go.
So he's walking.
Here we go.
And just imagining this, like, in this day and age.
Oh my god.
He walks in the schoolhouse dressed like a knight
after beating up a cop.
After beating up a cop. Carrying a sword.
An actual
covered
sword.
Covered in blood.
Covered in blood. He walks into this classroom, just walks in with an Indian guy, walks up to the kid from the beginning of the movie who asked for the autograph.
And how the hell does he know what school he goes to?
And hands him, well, it's a one-room schoolhouse. Apparently it's the only school. Hands him this freaking sword.
He went
sword.
To three others that morning. It was very awkward.
He hands this kid the sword.
A full-blown sword.
An actual sword.
Sword.
And then, like, turns to teacher and says, like, sorry, or whatever, and, like, walks out.
Yeah, wait, wait. We have to comment. After he walks in bloody, gives this kid a bloody sword, he starts walking out. Then, as he's at the door, stops and goes, oh, excuse me. Whoa! Little cheat for that!
And so then all the kids, like, gather on this kid, like, oh, he's got a sword, yeah.
That kid
still doesn't give this kid an autograph, by the way.
Yeah.
Still refuses to give an autograph, but here's a sword.
And the teacher is like, whoa.
Yeah, she's like, silence, kids. Get back in your seats. This kid's got a freaking sword
Billy,
now.
Billy,
yeah.
Put the sword away.
Yeah.
You can have it after class.
That school should be on lockdown, because...
Yeah.
Which should be easy. There's only one door. It's a one-room schoolhouse.
Oh. So now... Ed Harris is driving on the driving down the road, and so they've shown us in this sequence, in this sword sequence, that there's like blood coming out of this neck wound, the mysterious neck wound that he got early in the movie.
Yeah,
it's got an acute case of plot device.
Yeah, exactly. And this movie kind of then turns into like an anti-drowsy driving PSA.
Like it's an important message.
It kind of reminded me of something you would see in that,
right?
Where he's riding his motorcycle, but like
imagining it's a horse.
It's a horse. And Ed Harris, who is a great actor and is great in this movie, is not great in this scene.
Well, I still don't know what exactly happened. Was he? Because at this point, I knew he was going to get hit by a truck. I knew that
like,
was going to happen.
Spoiler warning!
It was clear that a guy wearing a knight uniform on a motorcycle who thinks he's on a horse was going to get hit by a truck.
We've all worked in news. We've covered this story countless times.
We know where this is going.
I knew it was going to happen. I didn't know if because you don't see the truck. It's off screen. He's looking ahead.
You don't even hear it.
So I don't know if either he saw the truck coming and was like, okay, this is the end. I'm not king anymore. I'm just accepting this. I'm going to die. And in his last moment, he's imagining he's on a horse and it's like his final fantasy. Or if he's losing so much blood that he's hallucinating and he's imagining himself as this knight riding through a field on a horse.
I like the idea that he's been hallucinating the whole time.
And not seeing this truck. It would have been better if he saw the truck as a dragon, but...
Yes.
That would have been great.
That would have made sense.
Let's make this happen.
I want to chase the dragon or whatever.
Yeah.
But, so either way, I don't know. Either way... He's imagining this. He's on a horse dressed as a knight or whatever. And all of a sudden you see this truck coming and...
He gets wiped out by the truck.
Creamed.
Yeah. And the end of the movie is a funeral for him where all the Renaissance Fair kind of people come together and this... There's some music playing and they kind of just do a funeral.
And Tom Savini's looking really, very sad.
And it's raining.
Probably because, like, this whole thing.
It's raining
and,
like, half
the
shots.
His fault.
Yeah.
Because some shots, everyone's wet and raining, and then it cuts to another shot, and they're dry, and it's just cloudy and windy.
And then kind of the end of the movie is just everyone rides off and the Renaissance Fair goes on with Tom Savini and
Charles.
Waiting for Knight Riders 2. Yeah.
I'm still waiting.
Return of the Dragon.
And, you know, there's so much. And it sounds like we're busting on this movie, but we sometimes knock movies, I think, on this show for not either going completely serious or not going full-blown comedy. Like,
right.
And there's something oddly beautiful about this. This could only happen in 1981. By even the early 90s, they would have, if you pitched this script, I can see this exact same script being made as a wacky Adam McKay, Will Ferrell comedy. Blades of Glory or Semi-Pro or something like that.
Oh, yeah, right.
But they did actually go the other way and took this 100% seriously. It's like a hard, hard drama.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the commitment to that is really, like, I can't, you know, while we are like making
Ed
fun
Harris
of the movie.
Gives it his all. Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. It is.
Yeah, he's not, he is 100%. I was listening Did you listen to the interview with Ed Harris?
Oh, yeah, that's my favorite thing. Somehow, just last year, they were able to get him for a special feature for this, which
I didn't watch any of the features.
I don't know what blackmail they had on him to get him to talk about this movie.
Yeah.
Probably all those YouTube videos of him freaking out on sets when he screws up. And I don't know if you've seen any of those. He's like a nut job on set. You got to Google those.
But, and he does seem a little uncomfortable talking about it. He seems like he actually enjoyed doing it at the time, but he's almost a little embarrassed about it now.
I think, he also hosted a screening in Hollywood, like, I would say, like, within the past couple of years.
Really?
And did, like, an audience Q&A afterwards. You know, I think he has said in some public comments, he has admitted he may have gone a little far. Like, he may have taken some of his... He was kind of acknowledging he was a young actor and may have, like...
Trying to over...
Gone to 11 on a few instances.
Absolutely.
Which I think just works better for the... Because it just makes it seem like this guy's delusional, which really works for the movie.
It works crazy. Yeah. I mean, for everything we're kind of, like, teasing about this movie, like... I can absolutely understand why this is a cult classic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if someone said to me, I love this movie, I would say, I get it. Yeah. You know, I get what there is, you know, I get what you love about this movie. If people are like, this is the craziest freaking movie to come out in the past 50 years, I'd be like, absolutely.
Yep.
Yes, it is.
I mean, well, we're going to do our So Wrong It's Right, and then we'll do our Is It So Bad It's Good. Our question this week is, George Romero's wife is in this movie playing a character. Obviously, there are only five female characters. So I'm going to list them. And one of these was George. And I should say this was George Romero's wife at the time, I think. It was not,
I think they got married.
Or married shortly after.
I think it was like the last day of shooting.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Actually, I think it is mentioned in one of the features. Yeah. Okay. They don't say who she is. But
okay. Is George Romero's wife either the queen, the female knight, the motorcycle grease monkey, Julie, the girl who may be dead by the end of the film, sorry, or the still photographer who is in a lot of the scenes with the Friar Tuck character?
Robin Hood character.
By the way, they also randomly intermix a guy from Robin Hood. Like,
that's true. I never thought of that.
It's taking the Arthurian legend part very seriously. I'm like, wait a second. There's also a character named Little John and Friar Tuck. I'm like, now we're just into... Now you're just mixing
up.
They had
so many characters. I had to just bring another...
Like, people were just like, it was all English. It's fine. You know.
Okay. No, I have to buy out because I recognized her right away, so I know who it was.
Okay. So I'll go through your choices again. The queen, the female knight, the motorcycle grease monkey, Julie... The regular person who got roped in with Alan, or the still photographer? Jack, which one do you want to go for?
I had an idea at first. I'm changing it. I'm going to say it's the female knight.
Okay. Okay. Gutsy call. Mm-hmm. Okay. Nick, which one are you going to go for?
I'm going to say the still photographer.
The still photographer. Wow. Nah, no wrong. Winner this week. It was the motorcycle grease monkey.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Which was funny to me because he's got her like... I don't know if they ever made out, but he's Tom Savini's girlfriend in the movie. But it's his fiance at the time.
And they do kind of an interesting thing where, like, I agree with Nick. She looks a lot like Penny Marshall, and they, intentionally cover her in grease And then, like, kind of later in the movie, they kind of clean her up a little bit. And they, like...
It's like the ugly duckling thing they do sometimes.
Yeah, they, like... Because you could almost kind of tell earlier in the movie, I'm like, I think she's prettier than this movie wants us to see.
Well, no, well, I think that was the point they're making, though, because she was saying something about she's not pretty or whatever. He's like, you always have grease on your face. You never clean yourself up. If you took care of yourself better, you don't put any effort into it. So then later on in the movie, when he comes back, she's putting more effort into it. I think that was on purpose.
Right. So the lesson is ladies, makeup.
Yeah.
So, and now we'll kind of go into, So Bad It's Good. We do that at the end of every show. I don't know if it doesn't apply to this movie in the way it usually does. I mean, I'll go first because I'm going to take kind of a cop out and say, I don't think this is a movie you can say it's so bad it's good. I think this is a movie that is just sort of good and just very much on its own merits and doesn't apply to any sort of standard reviewing system, does not apply to this movie. But it is a movie I probably would watch again. So I don't know what that means. I mean, but I would probably watch it again. And I didn't. And while it is crazy weird, it is kind of, I don't know, I was kind of liking it. So don't feel stuck to saying like you can do short instead of the is it so bad it's good or not. Feel free to just do your own twist on that. Cody, you want to go next?
I think it was so bizarre it's good for me. It was weird watching. Like I said earlier, I think it was interesting watching it because of all this George Romero players were in it. Seeing his wife as I don't think I've ever seen her in anything else.
Right.
Having Tom Savini be a main character was cool. Ken Foray's in it in a bit. The guy from Day of the Dead, which was made after this, was in it. So there's a lot of people who I recognize from other movies, and it was kind of cool to see them in one movie together. And the fact that the novelty of never having seen this movie before as someone who's interested in George Romero's movie was, like, weird, too. So I would definitely watch it again, yeah.
Okay. Jack, what do you think?
I don't know. I think if you weigh out the bad and the good, I do think it has more bad than good. But the good parts, I don't know. The characters were really... I liked the characters. And as bizarre as the crap they did, I could see the message, and it was a valid message. They were trying to make a statement that maybe humanity has grown too cold and they're yearning for a better time of family and friendship and fellowship and camaraderie and chivalry and nobility and honor and all that stuff. And I thought that was...
And motorcycles and
motorcycle jousting, of course.
And crazy insurance premiums.
But at the same... I mean, there are parts of this movie that I was just kind of like, ugh, like rolling my eyes at. But after it was done, I think thinking about it after I was done, I was like, yeah, that wasn't so bad. So I honestly don't know what my answer would be. I would watch it again, absolutely. I thought it was... It's original, which... It's original. The acting is bizarrely good. The story is oddly engaging. The characters are unexpectedly enduring. Yeah, I'd say it's good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Nick?
I don't think labels really, like good and bad, can really be applied to this movie. It's just so much in a field of its own. I've never seen another movie like this. But it was very entertaining. I will definitely be watching it again.
Yeah.
I definitely recommend others watch it. I mean, for all the crappy movies out there that have cult followings, this deserves to have a larger cult following than just about any other.
Yeah.
I mean, I was legitimately entertained by it. So I guess I'm going to just flat out say it was good.
Yeah, but I will agree with you too. I mean, I kind of knew this movie had a bit of a cult following. I'd never heard about. I'm greatly surprised I've not heard more about this movie in recent years. It should have a stronger cult following,
right?
in my opinion. This probably should be more. Maybe it's, and I don't know its home video release history. It may have had been very limited in. I know that like Romero made it independently. I think it was tied in with like MGM at one point. So maybe that explains some of why it's. Hasn't been out much, but this is a legitimate where you can say, oh yeah, that's why that's a cult classic,
right?
This joins They Live on the stable of movies where we're like, their own section of this podcast. We'll have to start up a different podcast for that. Yeah, start the cult movie. I want to get in.
Join the cult.
Join the cult, yeah. Okay, I think that brings this one to a close. More bad movies on their way. I'm sure Nick will be back soon.
I hope so.
At least Nick, we didn't call you like the Earth 2 like Green Lantern or something, because the Earth 2 Green Lantern was, there is an Earth 2 Green Lantern in DC, right? Okay, he always weirded me out a little bit. Jay Garrick always seemed kind of cool. Like whenever they brought in the Earth 2 Green Lantern, his costume was too much for me.
It was always just kind of slapped together, like, hey, red shirt, green cape.
Yeah, especially in the 50s, like, DC version. It was always like,
I will gladly take Jay Garrick.
Yeah, he was pretty cool. You could actually make a case at that point that Jay Garrick was actually cooler than the main, like, Earth 1 Flash. He seemed like a better guy.
Yes.
Yeah, he seemed like a better dude. So before we delve even deeper into the multiverse of DC...
Cody, you look bored over there.
I know. I probably better get out of this before things get really bad. We'll be back soon. More bad movies, more laughs. Until then. Ba-ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba.